Hi, you're watching a very special recording of Agenda Money right here at the World Comic Forum Davos. This is our fifth year in Davos. This is the 50th World Comic Forum. All the firefight is happening there at the Congress Center. We're just out there, the security force. Greta has laid down her words. And she went back to that 67% stuff that she's always talking about. Trump, I was waiting for him. But this interview that was scheduled, that I'm doing right now, is very important because everyone around the world, the moment you mention tax and taxes, that's very important. And you pay respect. In Malaysia, at least once a year, we'll do that thing that is necessary. So I'm very glad to have my new friend here, Jay. Jay is from the Midwest of America, but he's a global traveler, and he's an executive, a very important one, at Ernst & Young. He's the EY Global Vice Chair now. Before, he used to be responsible for looking at tax for EY. So I'm just going to go straight to it, Jay. I've been stalking you on your interviews online. A lot of the questions directed to you on YouTube that I've seen is about how digital technology will be disrupting taxes and taxation. But like I told you before our recording, all the sessions that I've been to inside the Congress Center in Davos for WEF 2020, they all mention about tax. Because the theme for this year is about stakeholders for, you know, a more equitable world, for a more sustainable world.
Right.
And even at the launch of the social mobility report, the first time ever by WEF, again tax is mentioned as a game leveler.
Right.
The inequality is growing within nations, and they say like the top 5% of a nation, for example, owns as much as 50% of the rest of the population. So then when I go on Twitter, there's this historian that claims he's never again invited to Davos because he spoke his mind out and he went back to taxation. He said the American tax system at one time even had a marginal ceiling right up to 81%.
Right, yep.
Okay, so because I am not that clever, especially in the issues of tax, not my favorite subject matter, only once a year for me. Can you quantify that into perspective? Because you've been looking at tax and at the global level for a long time. Why is there now a stronger clamor for using taxation to bring down inequality?
Yeah, I think there's a couple of issues that you framed. And when you think about tax, I'd break it into two different components. There's the taxation of individuals, which is some of the things we've talked about. Is there an opportunity to rethink the taxation burden and where that's shared, whether that is an income redistribution mechanism or whether that's a way to fund some social investments that need to be made in the country? And I think countries fairly are looking at that. It's a debate within the U.S. It's a debate in other parts of the world. And that is an element of kind of the equity, the fairness. But I think most of your macroeconomics would tell you that that's not the best way mm-hmm. to deal with the income inequality issue. The real issue is on investment and creating jobs and opportunities for people. That's where much of the noise is in society about, is there a fair and even playing field for people to make their own way? And that is about encouraging jobs and finding the way for investment to be made. And governments are starting to deal with what is their tax policy? How do they encourage business to invest? How do they set up operations? And then what's the appropriate amount of corporate tax, VAT, that's leveled on that organization that makes it competitive and attractive? And so it raises a number of issues. It raises an issue on competitiveness and tax competition, mm-hmm. right? Which I think is healthy for government and tax policy to try to encourage certain types of investments. Mm-hmm. But it's also opening a door on digital taxation because one of the reasons tax is on the agenda is the world has changed in the way that it both makes money, goods and services. Yes. It's gone from people and buildings and production facilities and individuals selling contracts, delivering goods and services, to much more digital. Much of our economy has gone online, where I don't have to be physically present, I don't have to have an office and a lot of people. And how do you tax that? And much of the debate that the OECD and other countries are looking at is saying, do we need a different taxation regime that allows us to understand where the profits are made from digital commerce? And quite frankly, the tax system hasn't kept up with that. Mm-hmm. And that's why it's an issue that's back on the agenda at the OECD level and looking at digital taxation. And that's clearly something that countries around the world are starting to try to address.
Taxation and policies are not recent. It's go back long, went back a long, long way to our first civilizations of mankind. However, when you look at it, with the first industrial revolution, the issue of resources really came to the fore. The fact that my side of the world was colonized over 500 years ago was because of the huge competition for the market capitalism to produce more at faster speed with the advent of the wheel, and hence they went off wanting to get the cheapest of resources in the most monopolistic of ways. Mm-hmm. Now, I mean, they are free countries all over the world, but when we put on the lenses of digital, I mean, in my country alone, over the past 12 months, four physical newspapers has closed down. Mm-hmm. Because the bulk of advertising expenditure doesn't go around the local media industry. Because of online advertising and everything else and revenue, the big techs, as they call them, the big giants of technology, which is pervasive in many countries, they get the most revenue. So the question now, if I apply from your perspective what you said just now, why are we not having it around when the impact of wealth creation digitally is clearly increasing inequality directly to those unfortunate countries and communities around the world and befitting the one that has the most resources and the highest level of technology?
Yeah, so look, it's a debate that's been underway really for the last 5+ years. It was started originally by the OECD, but really expanded to include a lot of the emerging economies that worked with the OECD. The first phase of it, the BEPS initiative, was how to stop what was perceived as being base erosion and profit shifting. And many of those provisions and policies came out about 3 or 4 years ago. They're in the midst of implementation. But one of the things that that working group recognized was that taxation of the digital economy needed to be addressed. So frameworks and principles were outlined, but they didn't really land on how are we going to tax the digital economy. The good news is there's now a robust dialogue on how to look at taxing digital economy in a way that recognizes some of the work and some of the technologies are built outside the country where they're consumed. So if you have engineers programming and figuring out the digital platform, there's intellectual property and there's value that's created there. There's also value derived from the customer base that sits in the country. Okay. And so the emerging economies have said, wait a second, let's not just look at where the value is created, but let's look at also where the economic activity is that consumes the value, and let's make sure that there's a balance. And so there's a number of fairly complex proposals that are being pushed out there that are trying to find a way to shift that balance. Okay. Ideally, though, you get a globally consistent framework, because if you have one country that wants to tax on base where the value is created and another that taxes based on where the consumption happens, you end up with double taxation, and that starts to impact investment. Mm-hmm. I think the other thing, though, that started to happen, particularly in Asia and Southeast Asia, is if you think about the demographics, there's a demographic advantage that comes out of Southeast Asia, India, and then eventually parts of Africa, that long-term, that's where the workforce of the future is going to be. So governments are trying to put in incentives to encourage innovation, technology, focus on blockchain, digital. Because I think the big companies that create some of these platforms recognize that the workforce they're going to need, the engineers they're going to need, might not sit in their country today. Mm-hmm. And therefore, governments are trying to encourage investment, innovation, getting the right people into the STEM programs, the science and the technology, the mathematics and the engineering. And so we're starting to see that as almost a talent play by government to try and, if you will, rebalance where this economic activity happens.
Fair enough. I will revisit that if we have time. But I would love to jump to the fact that even in the old days of books and ledgers, there were many ways for people to get through the enforcement of tax policies, for example. And taking the lessons learned at cybercrime and people who move money, hot money, from one jurisdiction to the other, what hope is there to really have an exhaustive digital tax policy and enforcement, when even in the old days there are always ways, and now the myriad of transactions involved and the global positioning where you can just park one source of information here and split the other that way, wouldn't the ability of the complexity of digital make it even more difficult for the tax man, as they like to call it, to come after anyone who doesn't adhere to the policy rule?
Yeah, so I'd say there's two things that we have to consider. One is in the profit tax space, the OECD recognized that they needed more transparency and information. So one of the things that was implemented by the countries are common reporting standards, country-by-country information on a organization's framework, their profitability, their org structure, but also all their transfer pricing, which is where typically that transparency will help lay it out for the tax inspector to understand kind of where the profit's made, where the employees are based, etc. That, I think, has already gone a long ways in trying to shed a positive light and a real transparent light on where economy and economic activities happen. I think that in the indirect tax space, in the VAT space, there has been some really positive developments, and it's all underpinned by technology.
Okay.
Government has to invest. The state tax service, the equivalent of the revenue authority, is increasingly investing more money in their own effective blockchain type technology.
Right. Yeah.
One of the biggest areas for evasion in the VAT space is on exports. Okay. And effectively getting rebates on exported goods that perhaps the underlying tax wasn't necessarily paid, shell companies, shadow companies, etc. But what a number of economies have started to do, right, Russia, India, Brazil, Mexico, many of those, effectively has digitized the entire VAT system. So every payment effectively gets almost a blockchain or unique payment identifier, and only when those are validated on the export that they were a legitimate payment do you actually get the recovery. That has transformed the kind of net recovery governments have made. So there's a enforcement, the technology can be the friend, as you will, of the tax authorities. And the good news is the companies that are paying their taxes actually welcome that. They get their refunds faster, they have quicker audits. The companies who don't want it, obviously, are the companies who are availing themselves of practices that they shouldn't be. And that has started to squeeze out the system. So the ROI to the government and the tax authorities tends to be relatively quick, because that fraud, corruption, and the leakage in the system kind of dissipates relatively quickly.
Interesting how many people, they don't dispute the fact that a more efficient tax system is imperative, like VAT, or in some countries they call it GST,
right,
goods and services tax. But there have been cases of where that has been rolled back because of the populist pressure from the people themselves who felt that when the embarkation to VAT or GST was done, prices of goods shot right. up because there's this delay in the tax charge to the repayment or the compensation or government giving back the taxes collected to the people who deserve to take them back in the supply chain of goods and services. So what's your views on that? I'm very interested to see that.
Well, I think that the GST or the VAT rates are always a sensitive political issue because in the short term there is obviously an increase that the consumer has. Economically, with the offsets, it shouldn't be dramatically inflationary. But I think one of the efficiencies from the technology is the pressure to actually increase rates actually comes down. Mm-hmm. The other thing that happens is sometimes the ability to provide exemptions on certain types of goods, it's harder to administrate when you don't have an electronic system. It's much easier when the SKUs on the products and the packages say that it's a different rate or it's exempt completely and it's digitized. And so I think technology can help relieve some of that burden. There'll always be some people who just, you know, don't want to pay any GST or any VAT. But I think the technology investments that we've seen companies and countries making have helped them to keep the burden on passing that on much lower.
There's also the snowball impact of, in order for VAT or GST to be really efficient, transparency is key. And the white listing of businesses, micro, small, medium, you know, and the big enterprises with the government system has got to be seamless. So not only is it good for taxation, but it's also good the other way around. In, let's say if government were to give incentive out to those who need it, it can be pinpointed directly. And that also means that, let's say, when e-commerce gets more active around the world, that database also serves as the same tool. So would you argue for that pain at first to be taken by governments or policymakers around the world so that actually just maybe 1, 2, or 3 years they could go really fly?
Well, I think, whitelisting and kind of putting out the Good Citizen Report, there's some positives to that. But I think that sometimes the compliance technically to get there is a burden that sometimes is, I question whether the value is there. Where we've seen it work in private is when the tax authorities sometimes will sit down with a company and they'll say, here is effectively not only your GST or your supplier network, but here are your supplier suppliers. And here are the ones that have perhaps companies that don't look like they're in compliance. Right. So the discussion becomes just like people look at their manufacturing, their supply chain to make sure that all their suppliers are complying with human rights rules and labor laws, etc. They're kind of going and saying, maybe this supplier here has people that are supplying them that you have a challenge or you ought to consider. Mm-hmm. And so that private conversation and the pressure is, your supply chain or your extended supply chain might not be following the rules. Do you want to participate? And I think that's a more effective way in the short term to put the pressure back into the system. And then, of course, it gets backed up with enforcement on the tax authority side.
Professor Schwab made a lot of references yesterday and today at stakeholder capitalism. Financial reporting, taxation are very closely associated, like a twin, to shareholder capitalism.
Right.
You know, once a year, the AGM, people look at taxes paid and, you know, see the accounting of the company. How do you think, coming from where you are, I mean, thousands of tax professionals in your network alone, how do you think the ESG reporting, for example, where environment, social and governance, not only the profit and loss, but also the accounting for the carbon that we release, for the water that we took away from the natural environment. Because unlike the first industrial revolution, we have less resources now that the earth can give to us. And if you take resources from my country, but 90% of your finished product through your IPs and services are enjoyed by other places and geographical locations, I deserve something. Because you're taking away natural resources from my area, for example. How do you look? I know this is a bit rhetorical in respect, but I think it goes together with the discussion that's going on here.
No, it's real. And look, the long-term value framework that many companies have started adopted, and EY is one of them, right? We have effectively taken our new strategy and said, we're going to be able to talk to how do we interact with our customers, how do we deal with our people, what's in it for them, what's in it with our external stakeholders, and as a regulated business, we have many. And then also, ultimately, the owners of the business, the partners who run it, and get that balance right. I think the good news is that there's a lot of initiative and a lot of incentive on a transparent and consistent reporting mechanism. I think WEF has pushed, and many of the accounting standards have started to look at how do I get consistent reporting on sustainability, on stakeholder engagement, on taxation. And look, I think that that's where we have to go, because otherwise, unregulated or inconsistent, anyone can report kind of whatever they want, but it isn't necessarily audited, isn't reviewed, mm-hmm. and it may not even be comparable. Right. And so that transparency of what taxes are really paid, mm-hmm. but also why are the taxes paid yes. in the way they are. Some companies have significant operations in jurisdictions where the tax rate's low. Yeah. So their overall tax rate's gonna be low because mm. that happens to be where a lot of their okay. operations are.
Cool.
But unless you're transparent about that in a disclosure report, it's not gonna be that obvious. And so we think that that's something that certainly we're working with the Big Four, but also other stakeholders, WEF and others can play roles in really talking about that. And at EY, we're embracing it ourselves to say, are we holding ourselves accountable?
How soon can, because I've just came from a Greta Thunberg, and mm-hmm. there's also one, so I thought there was only one Greta before this. So naive of me. Now I know there's at least 10 of them, young people going around WEF, doing the great things that they do. So they keep on wanting action now.
Yeah.
How soon can we see financial reporting, tax reporting, that includes not just dollars and cents, but also about resources of our social and the environment?
Well, I think you're going to see it already this year. We've already started in our report. I think what we want to do, and the companies, a lot of companies are already doing the reporting. What we want to push for is consistent reporting and apply that framework everywhere. But we're pushing very hard. In fact, we've announced our plans to be carbon neutral this year as a global organization. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of work we're going to have to do, but pushing that, and I think building momentum to put pressure on other companies to do that, and then implementing, I think the where the rubber really hits the road, where we really start to make an impact, okay. is where it looks and feels somewhat consistent, where there's some type of independent review of these are the 10 key metrics everyone's going to report, yes. or the 12 or the 15, okay. and these are how we're going to do it. I think companies will use their sustainability reporting mm-hmm. And their stakeholder value reporting to report more, but I think if you can land on a half a dozen key things. We've adopted 10 internally that we've said these are the 10 mm-hmm. that we are going to drive in our business globally around those four pillars of kind of our customer, the people, mm-hmm. The stakeholders, and effectively the shareholders or the owners. And I think many companies have started to do that, getting it to look and feel the same. I think within the next couple of years, I think you'll see a lot of momentum in closing the gap there.
Jay, just before I close, a bit of rapid fire. A lot of people talk about fintech and techfin, mm-hmm. but from what you have spoken so far, I think you believe in change from the inside. But do you think it's a race? Do you think that if you don't change fast enough, maybe in 5 years' time, there'll be a completely new set of talent with new set of gadgets and apps and whatever to do tax or financial reporting and everything else?
Yeah, I think there's an urgency on companies to transform their own businesses internally just to keep pace. And so will they disappear in 5 years? Probably not. But is there a major impetus to drive their own transformation to be competitive, to be cost efficient? Absolutely.
Would I be talking to an AI tax person, let's say, 3 to 5 years from now?
Yeah, we can introduce you to some right now. I mean, how we use AI already just data analytics and understanding not only our tax business, we use it extensively in our audit business and many of our other businesses, absolutely.
One last one, just for the Malaysian audience, a lot of talk about our quality of education, the future of talent. what kind of talent do you think? If they're thinking about joining EY and the AI-driven blockchain and big data.
What kind of talent? Can you please tell them straight?
Well, look, I mean, we're looking for bright people. We can train and educate you, so there's no magic formula in the school system. Obviously, people with science, technology, engineering, and mathematics all have kind of a predisposition to work in that space, but many of our best AI people came up with accounting and finance degrees. It's hard work, it's focus, it's a willingness to learn. And fortunately, at an organization like EY, we spend a lot of time and effort in training people. And I think the workforce of tomorrow means you need to be at an organization that helps you prepare for tomorrow. And fortunately, we're one of those in Malaysia. And all across Southeast Asia. Don't want to leave them out.
And you guys are lucky. Jay might just be visiting us in
soon. Yeah, I'll be there in March.
You send your resume, wait for him at KL International Airport. Do something that will mesmerize you. Jay, you have already mesmerized me. I never thought I could sit with a big tax man for more than 10 minutes.
It's so interesting, isn't it? Good
must stuff. Be the snow. Uh-huh. Must be Davos. Thank you so much to Ernst & Young. Thank you so much to Jay. I'll visit him in the Midwest, maybe if I settle my tax issues or something. But this is it. This is the discussion at the World Comic Forum 2020. And I'll see you in another episode very, very soon. Goodbye.